Committee on Human Services on Monday, February 27th, 2012, and we're having an informational meeting on the sustainability of developmental disabilities program. And we're going to have a group of four coming up, so come on up. Appreciate you being here on a pretty sunny afternoon.
My goodness.
Yes. And we've got all the lines closed. And just introduce yourselves and speak as you wish.
Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Mike Maley. I'm a manager in the Office of Developmental Disability Services within the Department of Human Services, and I'll be walking through the PowerPoint today.
Great. Do you want the lights turned down? Or?
It's your pleasure.
I think she's okay. Taking care of that. Okay.
Did you want to hear from everybody, or did you?
Sure.
Chair Tomei and Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities.
Chairs and members of the committee, first of all, I'd like to say this is the first time I've done this, so if I mess up protocol, please don't hate me. My name is Dan Pecha, and I'm the Executive Director of Self-Determination Resources. We're a support service brokerage that serves Washington County.
Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Jane Owens, and I am with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, the Developmental Disability Specialist. And so I'm here representing the directors and the Community Developmental Disability Programs.
Great. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for coming.
And before I start, I would just like to say that Mary Lee Fay, who is the director of our office, would normally be doing this. She had to leave town unexpectedly on a family matter, and sends her apologies for not being here. So hopefully we can do her some justice, because I know this is a very important topic to her, and we will do our best to convey everything. We've got several slides here, and the idea is to talk about our developmental disability system. And you know, we've always got kind of two jobs, you know, making the today part work as best as we can and meeting the needs of folks. But we also have to keep an eye for the tomorrow and what is the challenges that we face and that we need to address in some way, and what are the next generation of services that we need to consider as we try to just get better at what we do. So today we're going to be talking more about the future part, what we see as some of the issues that we need to address, and what we've got going to start addressing those things. So we'll talk a little bit about the backdrop. So there'll be three or four or five slides around kind of the background that's spurred our thinking, and then there'll be some slides about exactly what we are in fact attempting to do. So hopefully I do this right. Ooh. There are certainly changing demographics at play. This is some information out of the Census Bureau. It really talks about people that our age demographics as they're changing over the last several years. And what you see clearly is that as an average, you know, we're getting older. As a population, the red, the 55 to 74, 75-year-old is getting more of a predominant part of our population than it was a few years ago. And if you actually go to the very tip top, you know, the 80 to 85-year-old group, you see there's an expansion there. I mean, so people are, in fact, living longer. And in addition to, we're seeing the impact of the baby boom generation. And this is, I think, true for people with developmental disabilities as well. You know, this is the general population, but people with developmental disabilities are, in fact, living longer. And I guess this is simply the kind of the other thing that's happening, though, is from a workforce, you know, standpoint. And you look at the dark blue lines, those are kind of the typical caregivers, you know, in our society. And then contrasted to the trends that we just saw. And there's really getting to be a gap in where needs and care are going to be required and people to provide that care. And the interesting thing about this slide is this isn't a projection. These are real people. These people have already been born. You know, so that's a pretty accurate demographic. So when we're looking at some long-range planning from our standpoint, there probably isn't going to be even enough people to meet the care demands out there in future years. So if we had lots of money to support our service systems, we still would have a problem with actually having people to provide the care that's going to be necessary under some of the current models that are out there. Another piece of this is what's happening at the federal level, and this is a slide provided to us from the national association that Mary Lee Fay belongs to, and it just shows that over the years there's a bigger piece of the federal budget that's being taken up by Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Okay. So it's gone progressively higher as part of the overall spending at the federal level. And this is just another way to display that. If you look at entitled and mandatory spending compared to discretionary spending, you start seeing the divergence there. I think the point to make is that it's simply going to create the debate at the federal level, you know, and how that budget, you know, plays out on how Medicaid and Medicare dollars are going to be available. From a developmental disability system standpoint today, over half of the money that we use to support people with developmental disabilities is Medicaid money through the federal CMS waiver, community-based waiver program. And again, just restating that a lot of the services that we provide today are 24-hour wraparound services. People in group homes, for example, where you have staff shift models that really rely on a lot of people to make them work. And they're the most costly services that we have in our system. But again, if you're looking at some of the budget issues, as you forecast out, you look at the workforce issues in terms of that staffing, you know, there's a little bit of a collision, you know, course out there. And again, that's part of our thinking about how do we start to respond to that in the long run. This is just turning our attention to Oregon. Not a real clear slide, but this is our official forecast of people with developmental disabilities coming into our system. And if you look, you know, to the far left, in July 2005, we had 15,500 folks or so, you know, in our system. And we have seen this steady growth of people wanting our services through that time. Right now, today, we've got roughly 20,000 people enrolled in developmental disability services. And in the next 3 years or so, that's going to be upwards of 23,000 people.
So why the rise? Why is so many more people with developmental disabilities?
There's a lot of speculation about that. One of the things I can tell you is we're seeing a lot more children coming into our system, particularly children below the age of 15. And we are not only a long-term care structure, we're a lifetime care structure. And we're seeing more kids coming in with autism, drug-affected babies that are coming in. Some speculate that, you know, the worse that the economy has gotten, that the more people are wanting services where they may not have asked for them before based on employment and a number of other factors. So there's just a number of things that are adding to that, but it just continues to have this ski slope.
And this is not including the folks that I know that you're in particular interested in, people with brain injuries. Many of these people will also be needing 24-hour care, wraparound services, but this graph does not include those people, right?
Does not, unless that brain injury happened as a child, and then they could possibly become eligible for our services, just depending on how all the circumstances are.
Representative Gilliam?
So there's some, thank you, Madam Chair, there's some crossover, but you're right. There's a distinct additional population.
So
to this.
This is a real perfect storm in a way. We're seeing more and more people are needing services, if I'm understanding you telling us in your impassioned way. I'm beginning to feel very worried, and because I know we've talked too about people with other injuries, especially soldiers coming back with very severe injuries. So, and we're going to have fewer people taking care of them, is what you were saying in a previous slide, right? So I just want to make sure I'm reading this correctly.
I think that your comments are spot on. I mean, the things that we're talking about are not unique to the service system for developmental disabilities. They certainly cross over to other, you know, issues. But they certainly do represent the kinds of things that once they come to your attention, they say, we've got to start figuring out something on the long term.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love to find out if you could disaggregate a little bit of that data for me regarding the autism and the drug affected, and just which groups we're, you know, whether we're seeing an increase. If we're seeing an increase in terms of autism, are we seeing an increase in terms of diagnosis of autism, or are we seeing an increase because we're getting more kids in into the state who have come in already diagnosed with autism? I'm just trying to get an idea of where this increase is coming. If it's just the number of kids or the number do we have a cluster in a particular areas that we might be concerned about? I'd just like to know if that's possible.
Yeah, you know, Chair Tomei, Representative Frederick, our data systems are wanting in some areas, but we'll do the best we can. We can certainly, I think, provide some demographic information in terms of the disability that people have, and I think we can get it by area of the state. I know we can certainly do it by age, so we can provide a picture as best we can for you.
Well, if I may
follow up.
You mentioned demographic. I would be curious to see if it's possible to find out whether you are seeing something regarding economic, an economic component, whether you are seeing anything geographic, whether you're seeing something ethnically, because there's been a concern of overdiagnosis in some places for particular groups, Latino, Native American, African American kids being diagnosed with emotional issues and being put in special ed programs for one reason or another. I'd really like to see if there's any sort of way to break that down. Right. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I comment on that from the Autism Commission's perspective?
Yes.
The Autism Commission, which Catherine's a star of and I serve on, has begun to look at that data, but it is clear now that there are two factors, both the renewed understanding of what autism is and the fact that some unknown seems to be increasing the incidence of autism. It's now 1 in 80 children are diagnosed in the state, and that's across ethnic groups. I think there are some hot spots around the state, but it's a pretty general thing, and the incidence is clearly growing. But I think what this data indicates is people are being diagnosed earlier with autism, and then as they move through their life stage, I mean, I have an autistic granddaughter who's now a sophomore at Portland State. We're looking to figure out how to provide services for them. Some of them are functioning quite well, and some of them are not functioning so well. But I think some of these kids used to be misdiagnosed and then warehouse somewhere, and then pretty soon they were 30 years old and warehouse somewhere, and I think that's not happening. I think, although Catherine's I think really an expert on it, but we are facing an autism tsunami. It's very clear that that's the case, and it's broad.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Even with these glasses on, I can't tell what the two different lines are out at the right end of these curves. I see four items in the key and two curves. So could you help me out? I mean, they both show increasing numbers in the case management pool, and I can read that there are two different forecasts separated by 6 months or so, but which is which?
Representative Tomei, Representative Parker, the bottom line was our prior forecast, the fall forecast, and then the upper is the spring forecast, so it's the adjusted. So that would be the newest, most up-to-date forecast that we have.
the pessimist in me expected that. Thank you.
Thank you. Continue, please.
And this is some information that we pulled together a little while back. I think generally it still holds true today, but this is just to make the point that if you look at the bottom quadrant, that's the residential care for adults, and the one right above it, foster care. This is the money that we send out the door for services to people through contracts and what directly to providers. And that's roughly two-thirds of our budget that goes out for those 24-hour wraparound services. And notice the support services, because I'll be referring to both these things in a second. On the left, support services for adults, that's about 12% of that budget. And hopefully I can draw these concepts together here in a second. And these are the people. Okay. So if you look at the foster care for adults and the residential care for adults, again, the lower left-hand quadrant, that's about 35% of our population. So we've got about two-thirds of the money in services being spent for about a third of the population. And then the reverse is true. If you look at the adult services piece, the upper right-hand corner, that's about 55% of the population, and we're spending about 12% of the budget, you know, there. And that has some implications on some of our strategies and the models that we're going to be talking about in just a second. So where this takes us, and that's really just kind of the very brief backdrop. But what it tells, you know, all of us is what we can't continue to have a system because of the economics or because of just the labor force that continues to grow a 24-hour wraparound system. Either that's unsustainable at worst or at best, we really have to think of some different kind of ideas and options for that. And there's some kind of urgency that we've got to bring to bear here. So in October of 2010, with most of the information that you saw in the earlier slides, we brought together about 50 stakeholders, a broad-based group of stakeholders, and spent 2 days together and said, look, here's the data. You know, it's going to cause us a problem in the long term. Can we sit here and say and think of how do we address that in the future? And we really had a very productive 2 days and came up with several kind of conceptual cornerstones to move forward in from kind of a long range standpoint. Then in the last year or so, that group was broken into three or four different kind of work groups. Each had a major theme or topic to try to flesh out and come up with some recommendations for future action around some of the common themes, you know, that emerged during that two-day discussion. And it was a time-limited. People worked for about a year or a little more. And now what we've done is we've put together a group we've called the Sustainability and Innovation Group, SIG, because we have to have an acronym for everything. But that, again, is a broad-based group of stakeholders that meet periodically to help us marshal through the implementation of this, because many of the ideas, they're not going to come to fruition quickly, or we're going to yield benefits real quickly, but we need to keep the momentum going, and we need to keep stakeholder and other kind of perspectives, you know, on that. So we have that group going in it that also serves, we have a charter, and that also serves as a place where other ideas, if somebody else has a good idea about how to address the sustainability issue, the long-term issues, can come to that forum, you know, and express their ideas, so we have a place where new ideas can come and be fully vetted. So that SIG group has a couple of different functions to it. But in terms of this new paradigm, I think Catherine's going to talk a little bit more about this as a family, kind of from a family perspective. But one of the things that we realized is, you know, people with developmental disabilities are probably going to be with their families a while. And so the question then becomes, how can we in fact support families? And we started talking about that, and there's lots of discussion and ideas about supporting families, but that also kind of manifested into, you know, it's really people that are close to you by relationship. So sometimes it may be parents, sometimes it may be siblings, sometimes it could be other relatives, or it could be other people in your life, you know, that are important to you and close to you. So supporting families, because that's really where a lot of people are going to be living with their families for a long time. So supporting families in kind of the more traditional definition is really important. But we also thought, you know, it's relationships that are really the key here. Having people in your life that are really close to you because they care about you, not a provider necessarily, client kind of relationship. But can we think about that as a cornerstone for expanding services and how we support not only families, but people in that kind of relationship-based, you know, support situation. So that's one of the paradigms that we're moving forward with. The goals are really to, in the most overt way, divert or delay access to the higher cost services of care. Can we come up with different strategies, different models, different ways of supporting people, you know, where there is less dependence and a need for less access to those 24-hour systems over time. We've certainly got to be much more flexible in getting the right service at the right time. And I think for us, that really means having a different or some more options for people out there than what we have now, and some flexibility of moving around within those options to get the one that really fits, you know, for that person. We really need to think a lot about using technology. We'll talk about this a little bit later, but with the technology explosion in just recent years, and there's a lot of it that relates to supporting individuals with care needs, how can we buy in and tap into that, you know, as a strategy? And we've got to strengthen consumer-directed and controlled services. And this is really kind of a cornerstone of a lot of the thinking, and it really comes from the success of the support service brokerages, those services that were started with the Staley lawsuit, and where we had a lot of people on wait lists. That the concept is different, more expensive models. Can we do some in-home types of support? And simply put, those services, while they've been very, very successful, I think, from a cost standpoint, from a satisfaction standpoint, from an outcome standpoint, but the principles are pretty simple. One is provide, you know, how can we provide supports on top of what's already there in somebody's life, whether it's natural supports or other things that's going on to help them out. So it's an augmenting kind of a thing. And to the degree that people have choice and control over the resources and the type of services they get, just as a principle, people are happier about that, get better outcomes, and it is in fact less costly to do that. So that's one of the cornerstones, again, of some of the longer range thinking. So in terms of getting going, we've got to think of some new models. And just by way of visual aids, we have the support service system, that Staley system that I was just talking about, that has a $20,000 annual cap on the services. I mean, that's the maximum cap. Most people don't get there. Then we have our 24-hour system, the group homes and foster homes, our higher cost 24-hour wraparound system. And the average there is somewhere, you know, closer to, instead of $20,000 a year here as a maximum, you're talking $50,000-$60,000 there. And what happens is, since most of the people are now coming into our support services system, if that doesn't meet their needs, they make this long leap, you know, to the more comprehensive system. We're saying, you know, we got a hole in our system that we need to fill. And we're looking at two strategies to do that. One is to raise the limit of the support service piece, okay, and make it more compatible, and we have some information on where those lines should be. But the other is to fill that hole with some different types of services. And we're looking at how some other states are doing that. There's a model called shared living, And it gets back to that relationship-based piece where two people who really care about each other, you know, they're great friends, you know, they're cousins or whatever it might be, they know each other, they share the same household and they share the same life. Okay, very different than a foster home, you know, licensed and, you know, kind of thing. And so it's easy to get those two things kind of confused and interwound, but when we're talking about that, it's really different than an adult licensed foster care situation. It's really a relationship-based model. There's also some co-op kind of models that are out there that we're looking at, where people buy into a set of common services and then can augment those as is necessary. So there's a couple of models as a way to fill in that gap in addition to looking at expanding the support service, you know, concept. So people, if their needs aren't met, they don't have to take such a large leap into a higher cost service.
I just want to point out that we do all have meetings at 4:00. Okay. So I'd like us to be able to leave here at 5 minutes before 4:00. So I just want to call attention to that.
This is something dear to me, and I end up talking too much. So I will try to power through. I know you have it, and then we can leave plenty of time for people to on the panel to add their comments.
Great.
One of the things that we found in really looking at our data was some of the highest cost people in our service system were individuals 18 to 26. And what was happening, or what is happening, is many times they go into our more our 24-hour system, and we treat them like they're much older. You know, here's the place you have to live, here's your option, you know, and we don't have enough kind of vitality in our system to really help people go through the different transitions and kind of figuring out how their life's going to work. Because what was happening in terms of the cost piece is people would go into one type of service, then go into another type of service, and go into it. You know, we weren't finding the right niche in general, you know, for that age group. So we're really looking at different options that may be more intense in the beginning, but more this wraparound service concept that really talks more about, hey, where do you want to live? What kind of job do you want to have? I mean, some things, and really get people at that younger age group more focused in a way of a service way that's going to get them a less costly service in the long run. So it's just an interesting piece of information that we had. We need to, like I said earlier, expand the use of technology. This is an area where we're moving forward probably at the most rapid pace, you know, here. But technology could be anything from how do you use remote monitoring in a residential facility so you don't have to provide staff and make sure that people are still safe. That would be one end. To all of the personal PDA kind of devices, you know, the apps that you can put on smartphones to help people, you know, learn new skills or program out their day or find where they need to go without assistance. There's just an explosion of technology, even at that level, that we're interested in exploring and see how that can come to bear and provide supports for folks as opposed to a paid person to do those same supports. We actually had a conference on that a few months ago, sponsored by an outside party, one of our provider organizations, and it was just very energizing, and a lot of ideas were generated from that. And the last one, which is really an area of responsibility that I have directly, it's getting people jobs. You know, we have what we call an employment first policy and for working age adults, and that's that the first thing you should be looking at is how can you get a job under the belief that anybody can work with the right supports and contribute to their community, and it makes good business sense, you know, from an employer standpoint. So we're working very hard at that option. And there's obviously the benefits of employment, you know, that we can all know, from just the intrinsic benefits to supporting your community, all of those things that come along with being employed in your community. But from a system standpoint, if people have income, they have more choices, they have more control, and that leads to more options that we can think about in terms of less costly services, you know, for folks. You know, the example would be now you can afford to live in your own apartment, maybe with somebody, as opposed to, since you don't have income, you're living in a group home, for example. And so We are doing some things there. We've got 9 local leadership teams out in local communities trying to do some innovative things at the local level to try to increase employment options for people, getting local partnerships with businesses, schools, that type of thing. And we need to continue to work on our crisis response system. You know, people in our system go into crisis, and sometimes it's specific to that individual. Sometimes it's situational because of their support network. Something happens there. People, their parents get ill or whatever the circumstance may be. And we need to be more proactive in figuring out ways to respond to crisis so you don't have the highest cost outcome because we didn't intervene properly. Also, part of the crisis system is our SOCP system. That's a state-operated community programs where they're actually group homes around the communities by state staff. And really the mission of those programs is to, they're the programs that can't say no. If somebody's in a circumstance and no other provider, feels like they can serve that person, they go to a state op. But really the mission, it really needs to be clear that those are to be short-term to try to get that person kind of squared around and back into a different community option.
And what is SOCP?
I'm sorry. It's the State Operated Community Program.
Thank you.
And we're in the process of also kind of trying to right-size the number of those programs that are out there. And then the last couple of years, we've been downsized by, we've turned 8 homes over to community-operated other private entities to run those programs. And I think what we're trying to do is as the community capacity to serve people expands, we're trying to make sure that we're right-sizing the SOCP program since it is the most expensive part of our service system. We're trying to get the right kind of critical mass and balance it with what's the capacity and the need that can be met through our community system. And the last part, I'm just not going to read that, but really what it says is, we really got to continue to support families. And even if there were other options, we'd like it to be where families feel like they've got the support they need to care for the person in their family with a developmental disability.
So the paradigm shift that you mentioned earlier is not providing for people with disabilities 24-hour living somewhere else, but to help them stay either with their families or with some other kind of situation where they can get supports, but would not be in a 24-hour situation.
That's right, and that's
situation.
A relationship-based component
okay.
to it.
Great. Thank you so much. Catherine.
For the record, Catherine White with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. And I just want to say that the council is a federally established in federal law, funded federally, and our mission is related to systems change, advocacy, policy, and systems change. And so not only are we involved in systems change in Oregon, but we are also involved in looking at things that are occurring at the national level. This is something that obviously is affecting every state in the nation. I would say that Oregon is one of the more proactive in trying to address the issues that are going to be facing us in the coming years. We have talked, Mike talks about a paradigm change here, and the underlying default is that families will be continuing to do caregiving for many, many years. This is something that has been going on for a long time. It is simply something that we haven't articulated quite so clearly, and I actually am very pleased to see that we are looking at a really data-driven looking at what we need to do to change and to support families who are doing that caregiving. The Staley settlement changed what's called the social contract, and it basically said the state and public funds are going to partner with you as a family member who has a child with a disability, but there will be no group home out there to take your family member unless there is a crisis. And this is something that's been happening for many years, but now we're beginning to acknowledge it, and we're beginning to really look at what does it mean and what are we going to do. with the dynamic of increased cost, increased populations. I submitted some written testimony, so I'm just going to quickly summarize a couple comments. But I want to say that the rethinking that is going to have to occur is significant, and that we need to begin with the families of young children. As parents, we are bombarded. Parents of kids with disability, we're bombarded by what's wrong with your child. And this kind of deficit-dependent thinking kind carries through school, and it carries into adulthood. And we have to change that. We need to have parents have expectations that their kids, no matter how disabled they are, can be employed in some form, that there are options for continuing school, and that they can contribute and live in a community. So we've started doing some small things, and again, I've addressed some of this in testimony, but we've started working with families of very young children, four-year-olds, three-year-olds, sitting down and doing a process called person-centered planning, where we try to talk about what's your vision for the future? What do you see your child doing? And it is amazing that families start thinking about something they never thought about before. They never thought about their child having a future. A child with a disability is rarely asked, what are you going to be when you grow up? I mean, very simple things like that. And so we're trying to change the whole way people are thinking about their future of their kids and their expectations that the system is going to be there for us. We have seen over the years a continual reduction in funding for family support programs. We're looking at how do we do things more grassroots support in community-based activities. Our education system has got to be held accountable for outcomes. We've put significant investment in kids with disabilities, as many of you know. We've got to have real accountability for those outcomes. Also, I just want to say, as we're looking to change attitudes of families and helping them recognize that this is a lifetime, we also have to look at what families actually need and do something about it. Look at what does our data show. Our data shows frequently that people go into crisis when family networks collapse. So how do we keep them alive? And we've looked at things that we know need to be done, that we have not put together in a systemic, very clear plan on how we're going to maintain and support families. Families need crisis backup. They need respite services. They need some kind of balance. Maybe they can care for their 40 or 50-year-old son for 3 days a week, but they need to have some break themselves. So we're looking at those kind of systems. And then lastly, Medicaid does not support family caregiving. This is an issue at the federal level. So when we get funds, it really, there is sometimes a conflict between the family and the individual that they're supporting in that same home. We're looking to Oregon to do some things around addressing that potential conflict of interest, at the same time to continue to advocate at the federal level that there be a recognition of family caregiving. Every state is facing this, and the federal government is starting to pay attention to the fact that we have this whole different way of supporting families and individuals with disabilities.
Thank you, Catherine.
Chairs and members of the committee, my name again is Dan Pecha, and I'm the Executive Director of Self-Determination Resources, the support service brokerage serving Washington County. I'm also one of two representatives representing the brokerage system on the Sustainability and Innovation Group that Mike was talking about. Just, again, I'll be very brief with my comments, but I'd like to just say that, the support service brokerages are very excited to see this model expand. We work with a very diverse group of folks now. We have plans that are $0 plans. We have plans that are $21,000 plans. We serve people who have very significant physical and behavioral needs, and we serve people who are living independent lives, you know, making families, driving, you know. So we really serve a wide variety of folks. And we believe we have the skills to expand that to serve folks who are in some of these sort of these situations that would cause them to go into a crisis and be put into a place like a group home. But with a few more dollars, we believe we can serve those folks much more efficiently. And what we hear is, from families is, I really don't want my child to move away from me, for the majority of folks. I really would like to find a way to keep my child in my home and care for my child, my adult child. And without some of these things that we're thinking about, right now there isn't a way to do that. In addition, based on some of the funding models that we have within the brokerage system, there's one assessment tool that gets people a higher level of funding right now. And most of our plans, the cap for funding is at about $12,000, and that's in services. Now, we sometimes have folks, quite often have folks who go into crisis for a variety of reasons whose plans are at that $12,000 level. But because of the way the tool is set up, they can't access $21,000. They have to go from that $12,000 plan into a foster care home or a group home because of the way the system is structured. And again, I'm very excited that one of the things that the SIG group is looking at is creating another tool to say, okay, we know this happens. How do we look at these folks and what their situations are to kind of identify those folks who would potentially go into these more expensive services, but if we can add a few more dollars, we can continue to serve those folks. Because again, I think as Mike talked about, services are very relationship-based. And you know, I think as folks work with a particular personal agent, which is the case manager, and the brokerage, with the providers that are helping them, you know, in the brokerage, if we can continue to use those same individuals moving forward with someone's life, it creates a much better continuity for them and a much better quality of life. So thank you,
Dan.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, so for the record, my name is Sarah Jane Owens. I'm with the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, the Developmental Disability Specialist. I work statewide with all of the community developmental disability programs. Those are the programs that, at a local level, provide services. We do the eligibility determination, kind of the gatekeeper for people coming into the system. We also provide targeted case management to kids under the age of 18 and some of the folks who have not yet gone to the brokerage, and for everybody who is in 24-hour care, so those individuals living in a foster care home, a residential home, supported living. There's a couple points I want to touch on. One is the growth. For example, he looked at the larger numbers to bring that down locally. Clackamas County, for example, last year had 120 new people for the full year. This last year, in the last 6 months, they've already made 112 people eligible for services. So we do have this continuing need to expand our services and to create services that really will serve individuals in their communities locally without them having to go maybe to another community if they move into crisis.
I'm sorry, I don't understand that figure. So last year, there were 120 new people who came into the program. So far this year, not yet 3 months, you've got 112?
In 6 months, from July through December. Oh. And about 40% of the people that they're looking at that are becoming eligible are individuals on the autism spectrum, and they are children in that under the age of 14 group. So it's that increased demand for services. So the community developmental disability programs are really also very excited, I think, about this model. I've been involved with both the sustainability groups, and I serve on this SIG2 group, and watching the progress here. You know, we're really concerned about those adults 18 to 26 years old, because we see that when they come into the system, often it is kind of the revolving door, because they're not the right services. These are individuals who want to live on their own. They want to go out. Some want to go partying. Some want to have a girlfriend. They want to live life. And that the only service that we have right now for these individuals, if they go into crisis, is a foster care home or a group home that, by their nature, sometimes just have more restrictions. So we're very excited that, one, we could create some new models and see people be able to be more independent, more self-sufficient in the community. The other side of that is that we also know there are folks who are in our current 24-hour system who could really benefit from this expanded model. So instead of being in a group home, maybe they could move into a shared living situation or a co-op or another situation. And what we see is then maybe that would free up for if there is an individual who really does need that 24-hour support, that, you know, maybe there would be an opening then so that the system is moving and flowing. We provide services, again, to children under the age of 18, and we're very committed to doing planning and working with parents so that they know what the resources are, being able to educate them about creating a dream for their children so that when they get to the age of 18 that they would be an expectation of employment and not maybe other services. So we see that as a part of this concept that our service coordinators would be able to help in that planning process, working with families early on, so we can really help create outcomes for the future of individuals, you know, and for our children. Employment is critical, as you know. We've kind of talked about that up there. You know, many of the limits placed on individuals with disability is a function of poverty, not a function of their disability. And so individuals need to be able to have employment. That's why we are very excited about the Employment First strategy. And I think it is really crucial for helping people to have access to affordable housing, to and when we talk about paid employment, we're talking about kind of dependable employment, so that you have the ability to pay your rent on an apartment, to go on trips. And it just opens the door, I think, to more independence and self-sufficiency for individuals. As we move forward, we really believe that the systems between the brokerages and the counties need to be seamless, so that if an individual needs to move between the two systems, that they don't have a sense of any loss of services, that they can do that easily. That is one of our concerns. We are, again, very excited about the possibility of redesigning the system so that people who may wish or want 24-hour care would have access to that, but that we're really supporting families and, again, individuals in their local communities so that they don't need to, if you go into crisis, maybe move to another county or another part of the state because that's where the opening is. Sustainability is really about the right person having the right amount of time at the right cost. And we see this as really an opportunity to make our system more cost-effective and responsive to the needs of individuals and to family members. Now, you know, in summary, we know Rome wasn't built in a day, and so we are really, this is a progress, a process for us, and this is going to take some time. And our DD community, one of the things about Oregon is that there are a lot of strengths in our community and in the developmental disability community, that you have providers and parents and counties and individuals who are really committed to embracing change, making better lives for people with developmental disabilities, and working together. And so we really see this as an opportunity to really shift this paradigm and then to move into creating a better future for individuals with developmental disabilities.
Thank you. This is fascinating and I think very encouraging. I'm sorry, when we arranged this, we assumed we would have 2 hours. I wanted to give us plenty of time for the hearing, and I'm sorry we don't have that because we've got the floor session again at 4:30 and we have caucus now. But what I'd like to do is invite you to come back again. I know we've got meetings during the interim, and I don't know if we can fit it in there, but certainly if not during the interim, then next year I would love to have you come back. I'd love you to also to bring some families in who are getting these services. I'd like to know how it's working for people. As a mother of people in their 50s now, I identify with people who have disabled children and wondering, you know, as I'm getting older, if I had a disabled child, what would I want to see for them as they get older? So any quick questions, colleagues? If not, we will hear more from you in the future. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Close the meeting?
Oh, yes. Close the meeting for the Human Services Committee. Thank you.